Chapter 11. Battle Begun. 1. I can't see a thing, said Jane.
This rain is spoiling the whole plan, said Dimble from the back seat. Is this still Eden Road, Arthur?
I think... Yes, there's the toll house, said Denniston, who was driving. But what's the use, said Jane. I can't see, even with the window down. We might have passed it any number of times. The only thing is to get out and walk.
I think she's right, sir, said Denniston.
I say, said Jane suddenly. Look, look, what's that? Stop.
I can't see a white gate, said Denniston.
Oh, no, it's not that, said Jane. Look over there.
I can't see anything, said Dimble.
Do you mean that light? Said Denniston.
Yes, of course. That's the fire.
What fire?
It's the light, she said. The fire in the hollow of the little wood. I'd forgotten all about it. Yes, I know. I never told Grace or the director. I'd forgotten that part of the dream till this moment. That was how it ended. It was the most important part, really. That was where I found him. Merlin, you know. Sitting by a fire in a little wood, after I came out of the place underground. Oh, come, quickly.
What do you think, Arthur? Said Dimble.
I think we must go wherever Jane leads, answered Denniston.
Oh, do hurry, said Jane. There's a gate here. Quick, it's only one field away.
All three of them crossed the road and opened the gate and went into the field. Dimble said nothing. He was inwardly reeling under the shock and shame of the immense and sickening fear which had surged up inside him. He had, perhaps, a clearer idea than the others of what sort of things might happen when they reached the place. Jane, as guide, went first, and Denniston beside her, giving her his arm and showing an occasional gleam of his torch on the rough ground. Dimble brought up the rear. No one was inclined to speak. The change from road to the field was as if one had passed from a waking into a phantasmal world. Everything became darker, wetter, more incalculable. Each small descent felt as if you might be coming to the edge of a precipice. They were following a track beside a hedge. Wet and prickly tentacles seemed to snatch at them as they went. Whenever Denniston used his torch, the things that appeared within the circle of its light, tufts of grass, ruts filled with water, draggled yellow leaves clinging to the wet blackness of many angled twigs, and once the two greenish-yellow fires in the eyes of some small animal, had the air of being more commonplace than they ought to have been, as if, for that moment's exposure, they had assumed a disguise which they would shuffle off again the moment they were left alone. They looked curiously small, too. When the light vanished, the cold, noisy darkness seemed a huge thing. The fear which Dimble had felt from the first began to trickle into the minds of the others as they proceeded, like water coming into a ship from a slow leak. They realized that they had not really believed in Merlin till now. They had thought they were believing the director in the kitchen, but they had been mistaken. The shock was still to take. Out here, with only the changing red light ahead and the black all round, one really began to accept as fact this tryst with something dead and yet not dead, something dug up, exhumed, from that dark pit of history which lies between the ancient Romans and the beginning of the English. The Dark Ages, thought Dimble. How lightly one had read and written those words. But now they were going to step right into that darkness. It was an age, not a man, that awaited them in the horrible little dingle. And suddenly all that Britain which had been so long familiar to him as a scholar rose up like a solid thing. He could see it all. Little dwindling cities where the light of Rome still rested, little Christian sites, Camalodunum, Caerleon, Glastonbury. A church, a villa or two, a huddle of houses, an earthwork. And then, beginning scarcely a stone's throw beyond the gates, the wet, tangled, endless woods, silted with the accumulated decay of autumns that had been dropping leaves since before Britain was an island. Wolves slinking, beavers building, wide, shallow marshes, dim horns and drummings, eyes in the thickets, eyes of men not only pre-Roman but pre-British, ancient creatures unhappy and dispossessed who became the elves and ogres and wood-wusses of the later tradition. But worse than the forests, the clearings. Little strongholds with unheard-of kings, little colleges and covens of druids, houses whose mortar had been ritually mixed with baby's blood. They had tried to do that to Merlin.
and now all that age, horribly dislocated, wrenched out of its place in the time series and forced to come back and go through all its motions yet again with doubled monstrosity, was flowing towards them and would, in a few minutes, receive them into itself. Then came a check. They had walked right into a hedge. They wasted a minute with the aid of the torch disentangling Jane's hair. They had come to the end of a field. The light of the fire, which kept on growing stronger and weaker in fitful alternations, was hardly visible from here. There was nothing for it but to set to work and find a gap or a gate. They went a long way out of their course before they found one. It was a gate that would not open, and as they came down on the far side, after climbing it, they went ankle-deep into water. For a few minutes, plodding slightly uphill, they were out of sight of the fire, and when it reappeared, it was well away on their left, and much further off than anyone supposed. Hitherto, Jane had scarcely attempted to think of what might lie before them. As they went on, the real meaning of that scene in the kitchen began to dawn on her. He had sent the men to bid goodbye to their wives. He had blessed them all. It was likely, then, that this stumbling walk on a wet night across a ploughed field meant death. Death. The thing one had always heard of, like love. The thing that poets had written about. So this was how it was going to be. But that was not the main point. Jane was trying to see death in the new light of all she had heard since she left Edgestow. She had long ceased to feel any resentment at the director's tendency, as it were, to dispose of her, to give her at one time or in one sense to Mark, and in another to Meleldil. Never in any sense to keep her for himself. She accepted that. And of Mark she did not think much, because to think of him increasingly aroused feelings of pity and guilt. But Meleldil. Up till now she had not thought of Meleldil either. She did not doubt that the Eldils existed, nor did she doubt the existence of this stronger and more obscure being whom they obeyed, whom the director obeyed, and through him the whole household, even McPhee. If it had ever occurred to her to question whether all these things might be the reality behind what she had been taught at school as religion, she had put the thought aside. The distance between these alarming and operative realities and the memory, say, of fat Mrs. Dimble saying her prayers was too wide. The things belonged, for her, to different worlds. On the one hand, terror of dreams, rapture of obedience, the tingling light and sound from under the director's door, and the great struggle against an imminent danger. On the other, the smell of pews, horrible lithographs of the Saviour, apparently 7 feet high with the face of a consumptive girl, the embarrassment of confirmation classes, the nervous affability of clergymen. But this time, if it was really to be death, the thought would not be put aside. Because, really, it now appeared that almost anything might be true. The world had already turned out to be so very unlike what she had expected. The old ring fence had been smashed completely. One might be in for anything. Meleldil might be, quite simply and crudely, God. There might be a life after death, a heaven, a hell. The thought glowed in her mind for a second like a spark that has fallen on shavings. And then a second later, like those shavings, her whole mind was in a blaze, or with just enough left outside the blaze to utter some kind of protest. But this is unbearable. I ought to have been told. It did not, at that moment, occur to her even to doubt that if such things existed, they would be totally and unchangeably adverse to her. "Look out, Jane," said Deniston. "That's a tree."
I think it's a cow," said Jane.
"No, it's a tree. Look, there's another."
"Hush," said Dimble. "This is Jane's little wood. We are very close now."
The ground rose in front of them for about 20 yards, and they made an edge against the firelight. They could see the wood quite clearly now, and also each other's faces, white and blinking.
"I will go first," said Dimble.
"I envy you your nerve," said Jane.
"Hush," said Dimble again.
They walked slowly and quietly up to the edge and stopped. Below them, a big fire of wood was burning at the bottom of a little dingle. There were bushes all about, whose changing shadows, as the flames rose and fell, made it difficult to see clearly. Beyond the fire there seemed to be some rude kind of tent made out of sacking, and Deniston thought he saw an upturned cart. In the foreground, between them and the fire, there was certainly a kettle.
"Is there anyone here?" whispered Dimble to Deniston.
"I don't know," Wait a few seconds.
Look, said Jane suddenly, there, when the flame blew aside.
What? Said Dimble.
Didn't you see him?
I saw nothing.
I thought I saw a man, said Denniston.
I saw an ordinary tramp, said Dimble. I mean a man in modern clothes.
What did he look like?
I don't know.
We must go down, said Dimble.
Can one get down? Said Denniston.
Oh, not this side, said Dimble. It looks as if a sort of path came into it over there to the right. We must go along the edge till we find the way down.
They had all been talking in low voices, and the crackling of the fire was now the loudest sound, for the rain seemed to be stopping. Cautiously, like troops who fear the eye of the enemy, they began to skirt the lip of the hollow, stealing from tree to tree.
Stop! Whispered Jane suddenly.
What is it?
There's something moving.
Where?
In there, quite close.
I heard nothing.
Oh, there's nothing now.
Well, let's go on.
Do you still think there's something, Jane?
Well, it's quiet now. There was something.
They made a few paces more.
Shh, said Denniston.
Jane's right. There is something.
Shall I speak? Said Dimble.
Wait a moment, said Denniston. It's just there. Look.
Oh, damn it. It's only an old donkey.
Well, that's what I said, said Dimble. The man's a gypsy, a tinker or something. This is his donkey. Still, we must go down.
They proceeded. In a few moments, they found themselves descending a rutted, grassy path which wound about till the whole hollow opened before them. And now the fire was no longer between them and the tent.
There he is, said Jane.
Can you see him? Said Dimble.
I haven't got your eyes.
I can see him all right, said Denniston. It is a tramp. Can't you see him, Dimble? An old man with a ragged beard in what looks like the remains of a British warm and a pair of black trousers. Don't you see his left foot stuck out and the toe a bit up in the air?
That? Said Dimble. I thought it was a log. But you've better eyes than I have. Did you really see a man, Arthur?
Well, I thought I did, sir. But I'm not certain now. I think my eyes are getting tired. He's sitting very still. If it is a man, he's asleep.
Or dead, said Jane with a sudden shudder.
Well, said Dimble, we must go down. And in less than a minute all three walked down into the dingle and past the fire. And there was the tent, and a few miserable attempts at bedding inside it, and a tin plate and some matches on the ground, and the dottle of a pipe. But they could see no man. 2.
What I can't understand, Wither, said Fairy Hardcastle, is why you don't let me try my hand on the young pup. All these ideas of yours are so half-hearted, keeping him on his toes about the murder, arresting him, leaving him all night in the cells to think it over. Why do you keep messing about with things that may work or may not, when 20 minutes of my treatment would turn his mind inside out? I know the type.
Miss Hardcastle was talking at about 10 o'clock that same wet night to the deputy director in his study. There was a third person present, Professor Frost.
"I assure you, Miss Hardcastle," said Wither, fixing his eyes not on her but on Frost's forehead, "you need not doubt that your views on this or any other matter will always receive the fullest consideration. But if I may say so, this is one of those cases where any grave degree of coercive examination might defeat its own end."
"Why?" said the fairy sulkily.
"You must excuse me," said Wither, "for reminding you, not, of course, that I assume you are neglecting the point, but simply on methodological grounds, it is so important to make everything clear that we need the woman. I mean that it would be of the greatest value to welcome Mrs. Studdock among us, chiefly on account of the remarkable psychical faculty she is said to possess. In using the word psychical, I am not, you understand, committing myself to any particular theory."
"You mean these dreams?"
"It is very doubtful," said Wither, "what effect it might have on her if she were brought here under compulsion and then found her husband in the markedly, though no doubt temporarily, abnormal condition which we should have to anticipate as a result of your scientific methods of examination. One would run the risk of a profound emotional disturbance on her part. The faculty itself might disappear, at least for a long time."
"We have not yet had Major Hardcastle's report," said Professor Frost quietly.
"No good," said the fairy. "He was shadowed into Northumberland. Only 3 possible people left the college after him: Lancaster, Lyly, and Dimble. I put them in that order of probability.
Lancaster is a Christian and a very influential man. He's in the lower house of Convocation. He had a lot to do with the Repton Conference. He's mixed up with several big clerical families. And he's written a lot of books. He has a real stake in their side. Lyly is rather the same type, but less of an organizer. As you will remember, he did a great deal of harm on that reactionary commission about education last year. Both these are dangerous men. They are the sort of people who get things done, natural leaders of the other party. Dimble is quite a different type. Except that he's a Christian, there isn't really much against him. He's purely academic. I shouldn't think his name is much known, except to other scholars in his own subject. Not the kind that would make a public man. Impractical. He'd be too full of scruples to be much use to them. The others know a thing or two, Lancaster particularly. In fact, he's a man we could find room for on our own side, if he held the right views.
You should tell Major Hardcastle that we have access to most of these facts already, said Professor Frost.
Perhaps, said Wither, in view of the late hour, we don't wish to overtax your energies, Miss Hardcastle. We might go on to the more strictly narrative parts of your report.
Well, said the fairy, I had to follow all three, with the resources I had at the moment. You'll realize young Studdock was seen setting off for Edgestow only by good luck. It was a bombshell. Half my people were already busy on the hospital affair. I just had to lay my hands on anyone I could get. I posted a sentry and had six others out of sight of the college, in plain clothes, of course. As soon as Lancaster came out, I told off the best three to keep him in sight. I've had a wire from them half an hour ago from London, where Lancaster went off by train. We may be on to something there. Lyly gave the devil of a lot of trouble. He appeared to be calling on about 15 different people in Edgestow. We've got them all noted. I sent the next two of my lads to deal with him. Dimble came out last. I would have sent my last man off to follow him, but a call came through at that moment from Captain O'Hara, who wanted another car. So I decided to let Gimble go for tonight, and sent my man up with the one we had. Dimble can be got any time. He comes into college pretty regularly every day, and he's really a nonentity.
I do not quite understand, said Frost, why you had no one inside the college to see what staircase Studdock went to.
Because of your damned emergency, Commissioner, said the fairy. We're not allowed into colleges now, if you please. I said at the time that Featherstone was the wrong man. He's trying to play on both sides. He's for us against the town, but when it comes to us against the university, he's unreliable. Mark my words, Wither, you'll have trouble with him yet.
Frost looked at the deputy director.
I am far from denying, said Wither, though without at all closing my mind to other possible explanations, that some of Lord Featherstone's measures may have been injudicious. It would be inexpressibly painful to me to suppose that.
Need we keep Major Hardcastle? Said Frost.
Oh, bless my soul, said Wither, how very right of you. I had almost forgotten, my dear lady, how tired you must be, and how very valuable your time is. We must try to save you for that particular kind of work in which you have shown yourself indispensable. You must not allow us to impose on your good nature. There is a lot of duller and more routine work which it is only reasonable that you should be spared. He got up and held the door open for her.
You don't think, said she, that I ought to let the boys have just a little go at Studdock? I mean, it seems so absurd to have all this trouble about getting an address.
And suddenly, as Wither stood with his hand on the door-handle, courtly, patient, and smiling, the whole expression faded out of his face. The pale lips, open wide enough to show his gums, the white, curly head, the pouchy eyes, ceased to make up any single expression. Miss Hardcastle had the feeling that a mere mask of skin and flesh was staring at her. A moment later, and she was gone.
"I wonder," said Wither, as he came back to his chair, "whether we are attaching too much importance to this Studdock woman."
"We are acting on an order dated the 1st of October," said Frost.
"Oh, I wasn't questioning it," said Wither, with a gesture of deprecation.
"Allow me to remind you of the facts," said Frost. "The authorities had access to the woman's mind for only a very short time. They inspected one dream only, a most important dream, which revealed, though with some irrelevancies, an essential element in our program. That warned us that if the woman fell into the hands of any ill-affected persons who knew how to exploit her faculty, she would constitute a grave danger.
Oh, to be sure, I never intended to deny that was the first point," said Frost, interrupting him. "The second is that her mind became opaque to our authorities almost immediately afterwards.
In the present state of our science, we know only one cause for such occultations. They occur when the mind in question has placed itself, by some voluntary choice of its own, however vague, under the control of some hostile organism. The occultation, therefore, while cutting off our access to the dreams, also tells us that she has, in some mode or other, come under enemy influence. This is in itself a grave danger. But it also means that to find her would probably mean discovering the enemy's headquarters. Miss Hardcastle is probably right in maintaining that torture would soon induce Studdock to give up his wife's address. But as you pointed out, a round-up at their headquarters, an arrest, and the discovery of her husband here in the condition in which torture would leave him, would produce psychological conditions in the woman which might destroy her faculty. We should thus frustrate one of the purposes for which we want to get her. That is the first objection. The second is that an attack on enemy headquarters is very risky. They almost certainly have protection of a kind we are not prepared to cope with. And finally, the man may not know his wife's address. In that case, oh, said Wither, there is nothing I should more deeply deplore. Scientific examination, I cannot allow the word torture in this context, in cases where the patient doesn't know the answer, is always a fatal mistake. As men of humanity, we should neither of us. And then, if you go on, the patient naturally does not recover. And if you stop, even an experienced operator is haunted by the fear that perhaps he did know, after all. It is in every way unsatisfactory. There is, in fact, no way of implementing our instructions except by inducing Studdock to bring his wife here himself. Or else, said Wither, a little more dreamily than usual, if it were possible, by inducing in him a much more radical allegiance to our side than he has yet shown. I am speaking, my dear friend, of a real change of heart. Frost slightly opened and extended his mouth, which was a very long one, so as to show his white teeth. That, he said, is a subdivision of the plan I was mentioning. I was saying that he must be induced to send for the woman himself. That, of course, can be done in two ways. Either supplying him with some motive on the instinctive level, such as fear of us or desire for her, or else by conditioning him to identify himself so completely with the cause that he will understand the real motive for securing her person and act on it. Exactly, exactly, said Wither. Your expression, as always, are a little different from those I would choose myself, but... Where is Studdock at present? Said Frost. In one of the cells here, on the other side. Under the impression he has been arrested by the ordinary police? Well, that I cannot answer for. I presume he would be. It does not, perhaps, make much difference. And how are you proposing to act? We had proposed to leave him to himself for several hours, to allow the psychological results of the arrest to mature. I have ventured, of course, with every regard for humanity, to reckon on the value of some slight physical discomforts. He will not have dined, you understand. They have instructions to empty his pockets. One would not wish the young man to relieve any nervous tension that may have arisen by smoking. One wishes the mind to be thrown entirely on its own resources. Of course. And what next? Well, I suppose some sort of examination. That is a point on which I should welcome your advice. I mean, as to whether I, personally, should appear in the first instance. I am inclined to think that the appearance of examination by the ordinary police should be maintained a little longer. Then, at a later stage, will come the discovery that he is still in our hands. He will probably misunderstand this discovery at first for several minutes. It would be well to let him realize only gradually that this by no means frees him from the embarrassments arising out of Hengist's death. I take it that some fuller realization of his inevitable solidarity with the Institute would then follow. And then you mean to ask him again for his wife? I shouldn't do it at all like that, said Wither. If I might venture to say so, it is one of the disadvantages of that extreme simplicity and accuracy with which you habitually speak, much as we all admire it, that it leaves no room for fine shades. One had rather hoped for a spontaneous outburst of confidence on the part of the young man himself. Anything like a direct demand. The weakness of the plan, said Frost, is that you are relying wholly on fear. Fear, repeated Wither, as if he had not heard the word before. I do not quite follow the connection of thought. I can hardly suppose you are following the opposite suggestion, once made, if I remember rightly, by Miss Hardcastle. What was that? Why, said Wither, if I understand her aright,
She thought of taking scientific measures to render the society of his wife more desirable in the young man's eyes, some of the chemical resources.
"You mean an aphrodisiac?"
Wither sighed gently and said nothing.
"Well, that is nonsense," said Frost. "It isn't to his wife that a man turns under the influence of aphrodisiacs. But as I was saying, I think it is a mistake to rely wholly on fear. I have observed over a number of years that its results are incalculable, especially when the fear is complicated. The patient may get too frightened to move, even in the desired direction. If we have to despair of getting the woman here with her husband's goodwill, we must use torture and take the consequences. But there are other alternatives. There is desire."
"I am not sure that I am following you. You have rejected the idea of any medical or chemical approach."
"I was thinking of stronger desires."
Neither at this stage of the conversation nor at any other did the deputy director look much at the face of Frost. His eyes, as usual, wandered over the whole room or fixed themselves on distant objects. Sometimes they were shut. But either Frost or Wither, it was difficult to say which, had been gradually moving his chair, so that by this time the two men sat with their knees almost touching.
"I had my conversation with Philostrato," said Frost in his low, clear voice. "I used expressions which must have made my meaning clear if he had any notion of the truth. His senior assistant, Wilkins, was present too. The fact is that neither is really interested. What interests them is the fact that they have succeeded, as they think, in keeping the head alive and getting it to talk. What it says does not really interest them. As to questions about what is really speaking, they have no curiosity. I went very far. I raised questions about its mode of consciousness, its sources of information. There was no response."
"You are suggesting, if I understand you," said Wither, "a movement towards this Mr. Studdock along those lines? If I remember rightly, you rejected fear on the ground that its effects could not really be predicted with the accuracy one might wish. But would the method now envisaged be any more reliable? I need hardly say that I fully realize a certain disappointment which serious-minded people must feel with such colleagues as Philostrato and his subordinate, Mr. Wilkins."
"That is the point," said Frost. "One must guard against the error of supposing that the political and economic dominance of England by the NICE is more than a subordinate object. It is individuals that we are really concerned with, a hard, unchangeable core of individuals really devoted to the same cause as ourselves. That is what we need, and what, indeed, we are under orders to supply. We have not succeeded so far in bringing many people in, really in."
"There is still no news from Bragdon Wood?"
"No."
"And you believe that Studdock might really be a suitable person?"
"You must not forget," said Frost, "that his value does not rest solely on his wife's clairvoyance. The couple are eugenically interesting. And secondly, I think he can offer no resistance. The hours of fear in the cell, and then an appeal to desires that undercut the fear, will have an almost certain effect on a character of that sort."
"Of course," said Wither. "Nothing is so much to be desired as the greatest possible unity. You will not suspect me of underrating that aspect of our orders. Any fresh individual brought into that unity would be a source of the most intense satisfaction to all concerned. I desire the closest possible bond. I would welcome an interpenetration of personalities so close, so irrevocable, that it almost transcends individuality. You need not doubt that I would open my arms to receive, to absorb, to assimilate this young man." They were now sitting so close together that their faces almost touched, as if they had been lovers about to kiss. Frost's pince-nez caught the light so that they made his eyes invisible. Only his mouth, smiling but not relaxed in the smile, revealed his expression. Wither's mouth was open, the lower lip hanging down, his eyes wet, his whole body hunched and collapsed in his chair, as if the strength had gone out of it. A stranger would have thought he had been drinking. Then his shoulders twitched, and gradually he began to laugh. And Frost did not laugh, but his smile grew moment by moment brighter and also colder, and he stretched out his hand and patted his colleague on the shoulder. Suddenly, in that silent room, there was a crash. Who's Who had fallen off the table, swept onto the floor as, with sudden, swift, convulsive movement, the two old men lurched forward towards each other and sat swaying to and fro, locked in an embrace from which each seemed to be struggling to escape.
and as they swayed and scrabbled with hand and nail, there arose, shrill and faint at first, but then louder and louder, a cackling noise that seemed in the end rather an animal than a senile parody of laughter. 3. When Mark was bundled out of the police wagon into the dark and rain, and hurried indoors between two constables, and left at length alone in a little lighted room, he had no idea that he was at Belbury. Nor would he have cared greatly if he had known. For the moment he was arrested, he had despaired of his life. He was going to be hanged. He had never till now been at close quarters with death. Now, glancing down at his hand, because his hands were cold and he had been automatically rubbing them, it came to him as a totally new idea that this very hand, with its five nails and the yellow tobacco stain on the inside of the second finger, would one day be the hand of a corpse, and later the hand of a skeleton. He did not exactly feel horror, though on the physical level he was aware of a choking sensation. What made his brain reel was the preposterousness of the idea. This was something incredible, yet at the same time quite certain. There came a sudden uprush of grisly details about execution, supplied long since by Miss Hardcastle. But that was a dose too strong for the consciousness to accept. It hovered before his imagination for a fraction of a second, agonizing him to a kind of mental scream, and then sank away in a blur. Mere death returned as the object of attention. The question of immortality came before him. He was not in the least interested. What had an afterlife to do with it? Happiness in some other and disembodied world? He never thought of unhappiness, was totally irrelevant to a man who was going to be killed. The killing was the important thing. On any view, this body, this limp, shaking, desperately vivid thing, so intimately his own, was going to be returned into a dead body. If there were such things as souls, this cared nothing about them. The choking, smothering sensation gave the body's view of the matter with an intensity which excluded all else. Because he felt that he was choking, he looked round the cell for any sign of ventilation. There was, in fact, some sort of grating above the door. That ventilator and the door itself were the only objects to detain the eye. All else was white floor, white ceiling, white wall, without a chair or table or book or peg, and with one hard white light in the centre of the ceiling. Something in the look of the place now suggested to him, for the first time, the idea that he might be at Belbury, and not in an ordinary police station. But the flash of hope aroused by this idea was so brief as to be instantaneous. What difference did it make whether Wither and Miss Hardcastle and the rest had decided to get rid of him by handing him over to the ordinary police or by making away with him in private, as they had doubtless done with Hengist? The meaning of all the ups and downs he had experienced at Belbury now appeared to him perfectly plain. They were all his enemies, playing upon his hopes and fears to reduce him to complete servility, certain to kill him if he broke away, and certain to kill him in the long run when he had served the purpose for which they wanted him. It appeared to him astonishing that he could ever have thought otherwise. How could he have supposed that any real conciliation of these people could be achieved by anything he did? What a fool! A blasted, babyish, gullible fool he had been. He sat down on the floor, for his legs felt weak, as if he had walked 25 miles. Why had he come to Belbury in the first instance? Ought not his very first interview with the deputy director to have warned him, as clearly as if the truth were shouted through a megaphone or printed on a poster in letters 6 feet high, that here was the world of plot within plot, crossing and double-crossing, of lies and graft and stabbing in the back, of murder and a contemptuous guffaw for the fool who lost the game? Featherstone's guffaw, that day he had called him an incurable romantic, came back to his mind. Featherstone. That was how he had come to believe in Wither, on Featherstone's recommendation. Apparently his folly went further back. How on earth had he come to trust Featherstone, a man with a mouth like a shark, with his flash manners, a man who never looked you in the face? Jane or Dimble would have seen through him at once. He had Crook written all over him. He was fit only to deceive puppets like Curry and Busby. But then, at the time when he first met Featherstone, he had not thought Curry and Busby puppets. With extraordinary clarity, but with renewed astonishment, he remembered how he had felt about the progressive element at Bracton when he was first admitted to its confidence. He remembered, even more incredulously, how he had felt as a very junior fellow while he was outside it, how he had looked almost with awe at the heads of Curry and Busby bent close together in common room, hearing occasional fragments of their whispered conversation, pretending himself the while to be absorbed in a periodical, but longing, oh, so intensely longing, for one of them to cross the room and speak to him. And then, after months and months, it had happened. He had a picture of himself, the odious little outsider who wanted to be an insider, the infantile gull, drinking in the husky and unimportant confidences as if he were being admitted to the government of the planet. Was there no beginning to his folly? Had he been utter fool all through from the very day of his birth? Even as a schoolboy, when he had ruined his work and half broken his heart trying to get into the society called Grip, and lost his only real friend in doing so? Even as a child, fighting Myrtle because she would go and talk secrets with Pamela next door? He himself did not understand why all this, which was now so clear, had never previously crossed his mind. He was unaware that such thoughts had often knocked for entrance, but had always been excluded for the very good reason that if they were once entertained, it involved ripping up the whole web of his life, cancelling almost every decision his will had ever made, and really beginning over again as though he were an infant. The indistinct mass of problems which would have to be faced if he admitted such thoughts, the innumerable somethings about which something would have to be done, had deterred him from ever raising these questions. What had now taken the blinkers off was the fact that nothing could be done. They were going to hang him. His story was at an end. There was no harm in ripping up the web now, for he was not going to use it any more. There was no bill to be paid, in the shape of arduous decision and reconstruction, for truth. It was a result of the approach of death which the Deputy Director and Professor Frost had possibly not foreseen. There were no moral considerations at this moment in Mark's mind. He looked back on his life not with shame, but with a kind of disgust at its dreariness. He saw himself as a little boy in short trousers, hidden in the shrubbery beside the paling, to overhear Myrtle's conversation with Pamela, and trying to ignore the fact that it was not at all interesting when overheard. He saw himself making believe that he enjoyed those Sunday afternoons with the athletic heroes of Grip, while all the time, as he now saw, he was almost homesick for one of the old walks with Pearson. Pearson, whom he had taken such pains to leave behind. He saw himself in his teens, laboriously reading rubbishy grown-up novels and drinking beer, when he really enjoyed John Buchan and Stone Ginger. The hours that he had spent learning the very slang of each new circle that attracted him, the perpetual assumption of interest in things he found dull and of knowledge he did not possess, the almost heroic sacrifice of nearly every person and thing he actually enjoyed, the miserable attempt to pretend that one could enjoy Grip, or the Progressive Element, or the NICE. All this came over him with a kind of heartbreak. When had he ever done what he wanted, mixed with the people whom he liked, or even eaten and drunk what took his fancy? The concentrated insipidity of it all filled him with self-pity. In his normal condition, explanations that laid on impersonal forces outside himself the responsibility for all this life of dust and broken bottles would have occurred at once to his mind and been at once accepted. It would have been the system, or an inferiority complex due to his parents, or the peculiarities of the age. None of these things occurred to him now. His scientific outlook had never been a real philosophy believed with blood and heart. It had lived only in his brain, and was a part of that public self which was not falling off him. He was aware, without even having to think of it, that it was he, himself, nothing else in the whole universe, that had chosen the dust and broken bottles, the heap of old tin cans, the dry and choking places. An unexpected idea came into his head. This death of his would be lucky for Jane. Myrtle, long ago, Pearson, at school, Deniston, while they were undergraduates, and lastly Jane, had been the four biggest invasions of his life by something from beyond the dry and choking places. Myrtle he had conquered by becoming the clever brother who won scholarships and mixed with important people. They were really twins, but after a short period in childhood during which she had appeared as an elder sister, she had become more like a younger sister, and had remained so ever since. He had wholly drawn her into his orbit. It was her large, wondering eyes and the naïve answers to his accounts of the circle he was now moving in, which had provided at each stage most of the real pleasure of his career. But for the same reason she had ceased to mediate life from beyond the dry places. The flower, once safely planted among the tin cans, had turned into a tin can itself.
Pearson and Deniston he had thrown away, and he now knew for the first time what he had secretly meant to do with Jane. If all had succeeded, if he had become the sort of man he hoped to be, she was to have been the great hostess, the secret hostess, in the sense that only the very esoteric few would know who that striking-looking woman was and why it mattered so enormously to secure her goodwill. Well, it was lucky for Jane. She seemed to him, as he now thought of her, to have in herself deep wells and knee-deep meadows of happiness, rivers of freshness, enchanted gardens of leisure, which he could not enter, but could have spoiled. She was one of those other people, like Pearson, like Deniston, like the Dimbles, who could enjoy things for their own sake. She was not like him. It was well that she should be rid of him. At that moment came the sound of a key turning in the lock of the cell door. Instantly all these thoughts vanished. Mere physical terror of death, drying the throat, rushed back upon him. He scrambled to his feet and stood with his back against the furthest wall, staring as hard as if he could escape hanging by keeping whoever entered steadily in sight. It was not a policeman who came in. It was a man in a grey suit whose pince-nez, as he glanced towards Mark and towards the light, became opaque windows, concealing his eyes. Mark knew him at once, and knew that he was at Belbury. It was not this that made him open his own eyes even wider and almost forget his terror in his astonishment. It was the change in the man's appearance, or rather, the change in the eyes with which Mark saw him. In one sense, everything about Professor Frost was as it had always been. The pointed beard, the extreme whiteness of forehead, the regularity of features, and the bright Arctic smile. But what Mark could not understand was how he had ever managed to overlook something about the man so obvious that any child would have shrunk away from him, and any dog would have backed into the corner with raised hackles and bared teeth. Death itself did not seem more frightening than the fact that only 6 hours ago he would, in some measure, have trusted this man, welcomed his confidence, and even made believe that his society was not disagreeable.